Greetings. I'm on the phone today with Dr. Robert Stenzel, author of Sky and Telescope's major feature article about Epsilon Auriga that is appearing in our March 2012 issue. The article talks about some of the major mysteries surrounding this eclipsing binary, and also these recent studies during the recent eclipse that are help resolving some of the mysteries. We're also including sidebars by amateur astronomers about the major amateur contribution to the study of this enigmatic star. Dr. Stenzel, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to speak with you and your readers.
Great. I want to start off by noting you did an article for us a couple years ago, right before the start of the eclipse season. What is it about Epsilon Auriga that really intrigues you and other astronomers, both professional and amateur, that that has really made it such an intense focus of observational scrutiny?
Well, I think there's a number of factors, but I would point to becoming acquainted with Epsilon Auriga way back when I was a postdoc in the 1980s, and there were new observational capabilities at that time, a forerunner of the Hubble Space Telescope, and it seemed like we finally had a new set of tools that would allow us to crack open the problems presented by Epsilon Auriga.
Right, and certainly in this latest eclipse, and I thought you explained this quite well, that there were many, many different telescopes, instruments, space, ground, professional, amateur, that got very good observations. I mean, was this kind of a coordinated international campaign, or was it a case of just lots of astronomers using different instruments, different countries, different institutions, taking an interest in this star?
Well, there's a lot of factors, again, involved with what happens observationally. And as you point out, in the advanced amateur community, the availability of tools and the general education level has just opened up this proliferation of observational capability, and talk about a golden age of astronomy between ground and space assets. We were able to observe literally from the far ultraviolet all the way out to the near radio regime this time around, and talk about new techniques and new tools, especially interferometric ones. We've got our best chance ever to break open the secrets inside Epsilon Auriga.
Right, and you mentioned the interferometric observations, and of course you mentioned in the article the Chara array observations on Mount Wilson, and we ran several images. I remember when I first saw those images of that disk moving in front of the star, I was really completely blown away by that. What was the reaction of you and your colleagues when you first really processed the data and realized what you were seeing?
It was amazing. We were actually on station at Mount Wilson, where the Chara array sits, and collecting data on a second night when John Monnier emailed the first image processing to me. And it's one of those jaw-dropping moments. People had used interferometric imaging for some time to observe the shape of stars, and most of them look round, or some are elliptical due to fast rotation. But this star had a major munch bite out of the side of it, and we knew we had something special because for the first time in 170 years, we were able to demonstrate exactly what was causing the eclipse. And just if I may add, when Nature ran the article, Nature magazine, a few months later, Ed Guinan, who is hopefully known to some of your readers as a real premier binary star expert, I thought he just put it over the top when he mentioned how people since the ancient Greeks have studied eclipses to learn more and more about the universe. Consider Aristophanes and the shape of the Earth and the distance of the Sun, those kinds of things. Putting us with that observation in that league, just wonderful, wonderful thing.
And as you mentioned in the article, I mean, I think those pictures really definitively clinch the case now. There's absolutely no doubt that there's this disk of dust and gas that's causing the eclipse. I mean, I would think that is, you know, a huge part of the mystery that we can now say is definitively solved. Would you agree with that?
Well, yes, very much so. It certainly gives us a major lever to try to analyze the system. Now we know the shape of the thing causing the eclipse. And, you know, in this life, so many things are fuzzy and uncertain. Getting a hard fact, that's hard won and very valuable, of course.
And that raises the question of where the disk comes from. Mm-hmm. I know that it's not a resolved question right now. What's kind of the latest, you know, theories about the origin of that disk?
Well, I have my pet ideas about this, and am trying to amass the evidence toward this end. In fact, we've been fortunate to collaborate with another user of the Char Array, Denis Mourard from Nice Observatory, who's using what's called the Vega beam combiner. It's an optical spectro-interferometric device, and this is work in progress. The interferometric imaging we just spoke about was using the Michigan infrared beam combiner. That basically is a camera. The Vega spectro-interferometric combiner allows us to dig deeper into the spectrum and to literally get images in spectrum lines. This kind of thing has been done with the sun. Some of your readers should be familiar with spectroheliographic images, where you see, for example, if you tune your Coronado into the H-alpha line, you see a different appearance to the sun. So similarly, at Charo with the Vega combiner, we're beginning to get the first glimpses of how the star looks at different wavelengths and different opacities, which is the next dimension beyond what the Merck imager was able to do.
Of course, that disk isn't surrounding the visible star in the system. It sounds like, other than the mass, that the visible star is pretty well characterized. It's kind of an evolved star, you know, roughly maybe 4 to 10 times, maybe a little more massive than the sun. But this disk is surrounding a star that remains hidden from view, but that these recent observations, we're starting to learn a little bit more about it. And it appears to be kind of a very hot star, like probably an O or B star. What would you say right now, you know, besides that, is our best understanding of the nature of this star?
Well, I think you're on the right track there. Classically, one looks at EPSAR, it's a bright winter star in constellation Auriga, and when you figure out that it's 2,000 light years away and it's third magnitude, it must be intrinsically very bright, very high wattage. Normally, we call those supergiants, and normally they have 10 to 20 solar masses of material. The unseen companion, though, seems to be comparably massive, but it's dark. So either it's this big chunk of dark matter, or, which has long been the confusion, of course, or it is something hidden. Now that we know it's hidden by a disk, we begin to drill into the possibilities and begin to appreciate the fact that the bright star might not necessarily be a massive object. It may be the ghost remnant of some evolved object. The popular term now is post-AGB star, some kind of maybe initially 8 solar mass object that's thrown off up to half of its material. It's conceivable within conservative mass transfer binary star theory that half of that material ended up on its companion, which may have been a prosaic solar-type star initially, but ended up doubling or quadrupling its mass in the process. And hence, we're left with a residual disk hiding the bugger, except we are seeing hints of it in high-temperature lines in the infrared, possibly the optical. And the object is accreting that disk that's surrounding it, but there is potentially time to even allow planetary bodies to start forming in a disk like that.
That would be really interesting if there were planets embedded, you know, inside that disk orbiting the hidden star. I guess that cannot be ruled out right now.
Well, in fact, the evidence is tilting in favor of something to that effect. If I may explain briefly, and this is, you know, up to the second insight that your listeners are getting. When we observe the Merck disk at Chara, we see a certain thickness. When we look at the Vega data, we're seeing a disk that's much fluffier because we're tracing more of the gaseous hydrogen component as opposed to what Merck sees, which is the dust particles. The thickness, the relative thickness of the disk in those two methods is telling us a lot about the internal structure, because an ordinary cold disk would tend to flatten out to the thickness of Saturn's rings, be very thin. And as you know, Saturn during the right phases, it's almost impossible to see the ring of Saturn or its thinness. Something is fluffing up the dust disk in EPSOR, and the possibilities include the periastron passage of the Big Neighbor, or there could be stirring going on inside, the way asteroids tend to stir planetary bodies. Some of your readers may be aware that the asteroid belt of the solar system has a particular thickness to it because of the perturbations of Jupiter particularly. We could potentially be on the cusp of detecting those kinds of things. Not saying we're finding planets yet, but something is dynamically stirring the disk, maintaining its thickness.
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting possibility. And that sort of raises the next question, and you discussed this briefly at the end of your article, is what kind of observations could we be making in the next several decades before the next eclipse that might tell us more about the nature of the disk and also the star hidden inside of it?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a couple of facilities that we're actively looking at now. One is the SOFIA airplane, the airborne telescope, and that has capability to look out in the far infrared and submillimeter bands. What we can do there is try to detect additional molecular features. One of the current questions is the gas and dust content of that disk. How much gas is there? We do see some evidence of cometary-like sublimation during mid-eclipse, suggesting there might be bodies with icy surfaces that are getting superheated and outgassing, much like comets. But getting some additional molecular measurements would be a real key step in trying to strengthen that idea. The other important facility is good old Hubble Space Telescope. It has a fabulous new cosmic origin spectrograph, and we were lucky to get three epochs during total eclipse showing what the far ultraviolet is doing. That's certainly a tracer of the hot stuff, the accretion or the hot star itself, and it would be extremely useful to get at least one more post-eclipse measurement for comparison.
Mm-hmm.
So those are short-term some things to do. We're also looking at maybe the Very Large Array as a way to make some additional radio wavelength measurements, because now we have a good set of measurements of the brightness of the disk. The disk becomes the dominant source in the star when you get out into the long wave infrared. In other words, it outshines the F star itself. And so if we can collect new data at the longest wavelengths, especially spectral data, we have a better chance of characterizing the dust and maybe the molecules present